Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don is a biochemist and a member of the board at Creation Moments, and we've picked just a gem of an article to talk about today. Don, how you doing? How are things down there in the Southland?
Well, today, yesterday, and the last couple of days, it's been bright and sunny and warm. We're back up into the 70s again this week, but later in the week, it's going to rain and get a little cooler again.
Okay, well, and I feel
but not as cold as you folks.
Well, no, but this is still January, at least through the day today, and this East Dakota gets pretty cold in January. And it's traditional, we brace ourselves for it. And as a matter of fact, if you really think about it, it's why we're here. We don't come here for warmth.
It?
No, we don't come here for warmth. And so we're enjoying this while it lasts, because it lasts a long time. It does.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, I'm sure.
Well, we do our
not
best.
Not sure why.
We keep
not
our
sure
chins
why
up
we
here.
Come here. Yeah. Why do we come here? Do
it's,
we?
It's for the solace. Ever, the solace of the place is why we're here.
I think I ask myself that question every January.
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing here?
Yeah.
You know, I know where the southern. I know which direction south is.
Sure.
And west. I've actually been there, and I lived in Arizona for 10 years. I'm not totally anticlimactic. there was a little teeny tiny flash in my brain that went off just before I said that word.
It's a wild synapse. There's a one.
Warning. Watch it. Careful. This word may be difficult.
But funny you should bring up. Funny you should bring up climate, though, and especially warm climates.
Yeah.
Because there's, I'm reading this article over at the Smithsonian. By the way, for our listeners, there's now a link to this same article in the chat window at RokenRoadRadio.com. And it talks about changing climate, and it's talking specifically about climate change in Australia a long time ago, not the one that people claim we're experiencing right now. In fact, Don, your thoughts. I have no problem with saying, yes, there is climate change going on. But I would add that there's always climate change going on, always has been, and always will be, as long as we're going to be around here. What do you say to that?
Oh, I would say you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just this, you know, this is nothing new. It's interesting, though, in this article, they attribute the dying off, if you will, of these huge versions of wombats and kangaroos and everything. The larger versions, they attribute that to a warmer climate, and this was a change in thinking, because they were originally attributing the die-off of these huge species
talking about wombats the size of Volkswagens and cousins to the koala that resembled the mythical drop bear. Now, I've never heard of a drop bear. I don't know what that is. But enormous venomous lizards larger than Komodo dragons living in Australia back then. Australia's always had some really strange animals there, I think. And I'm not sure why that should be, other than maybe they're by themselves in all that water. And I don't know. I don't know why, but there are weird ones. And the big ones seem to have disappeared. And what did science conclude before this change of mind happened? What happened to those animals?
Well, they say that they blamed it on the Aborigines.
Oh.
And man's involvement in burning grasslands and stuff, and burning the food source, and that killed off the big ones. But there's a completely total different explanation, of course. You know, if you look at the geology, and if you look at take a young Earth perspective, we know that there was a global flood, for example, and that wasn't all that long ago. That was about 4,500 years ago that we had a global flood, and you can read about it in Genesis. You know, you can read about the global flood. There are other extra biblical books, like the Book of Jairus, for example, that also describes the flood in a little bit more detail in certain areas. And, of course, we have over 200 flood stories or flood-related stories in the cultures, from cultures, ancient cultures around the world. Now, not all of them are describing the same thing, and it looks like, you know, the boat is sometimes described differently, but oftentimes in those stories you'll have eight people that got on a boat and they traveled somewhere, and then finally the boat came to rest, and the rest is is history.
So this really represents kind of a collective memory, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, of course, the take the flood narrative, for example, where we know, that Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives were saved from a global catastrophe that God warned about, actually 120 years earlier. Because they believed God, because they obeyed him and built the ark, it wound up that only he and his family, you know, got saved. Even though Moses and Methuselah were preaching for 120 years that this event is going to come.
Well, not Moses. And, not Moses. We want to backtrack there, I think.
I mean, excuse me, Noah.
Yeah, Noah.
Moses
there
wasn't
go.
There yet.
No. He was just a glimmer in God's eye at that point, I think.
Yes, exactly. But, Noah and, Methuselah were preaching all this time that this flood was coming, and it was God's wrath on the people, because the people's thoughts were continuously evil, and we talked about the Nephilim at one point in time, and so there was a contamination of, if you will, the DNA of man, so that had to be cleaned up as well. So there was this big catastrophe coming, and even up to the week before the flood was going to come, there were events starting to take place on Earth that were shaking things up a bit. And that was a literal shaking. I mean, the folks had never experienced, let's say, earthquakes, but there were massive shakings that were going on the week prior to the flood, and yet the people still did not come onto the ark. There was plenty of room for a whole bunch of people, but they, because of the evilness of their thoughts, they just weren't going to believe it and wound up suffering the consequences. All right, now what does that have to do with the story that that we're talking about, the article that we're talking about today? Well, you know, Australia was once part of a large mega continent, if you will. The one, the Pangaea, which we've talked about in the past, was one big landmass, which all of the current day continents came from, including Australia. And so Australia broke off when the continent started to break up, and the most logical explanation as to when did the continent start to break up is, well, it was at the time of the flood, because there were a lot of pressure on the earth at that time, and so the continent started to break up, Australia started to break away, and what and that was probably happening either while the flood was going on, and certainly happening post-flood. You had a lot of, not only a lot of earthquakes, but you also had a lot of volcanic activity at the time. And the volcanic activity would probably go through, cycles. There would be times when there's more volcanic activity, and the times when there was a little bit less. And what wound up happening after the flood because you had a very temperate climate before the flood. And so these, you know, animals grew bigger. They lived longer. Man was living to, on an average, 900 years.
And one of the most intriguing things, Don, I would always like to point this up when we tell this story, a fairly consistent climate north to south.
Yes. Yes, because the unlike we have today, where the continents are separated, you know, on the Earth, the continents were obviously, it was just one large continent, so it was all compacted together, and the environment, as God Himself proclaimed it at the time of creation, was that it was very good, that it was perfect. So not only was all of His creation now perfect once He created Adam and Eve. But everything was perfect, including the climate for life. And so it's not surprising, at least to me and several other creationists, that, hey, life was bigger back then because the environment was better. The environment was perfect. So you had perfect air. You didn't have any air pollution. You didn't have any radiation coming from the sun that would be harmful to life. And you would have giant, you know, leaves on trees and vegetation, and of course animals would grow bigger. So these big animals that they are talking about that they find on Australia were probably pre-flood as opposed to post-flood. Now the animals were obviously there, but you know, the Bible documents that all life on land perished as they knew it back then. So that meant that any animal that was, including man, that was on that piece of land perished. And so you wound up with a, you know, big chunk of land that had very little on it, but all kinds of animals were on the ark. The land animals, that is. And so they would have migrated. You would have had animals that migrated from, let's say, the mountains of Ararat eventually to back on that landmass, because they migrated all over the world and migrated, you know, over to you know, up into Russia. And
which does suggest, doesn't it, Don, at that time, that Australia must have still been part of the larger landmass.
Otherwise, yes, there had to be a land bridge of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how long was that, you know, connected? Or was there, you know, maybe the water wasn't that deep at that time between the continents? Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know.
But this brings me back to my first observation, that Australia seems to have a different collection of animals. So let me explain it this way. Animals migrated shortly after the flood and got to what would become Australia. It floated away and isolated them. And so it was their microclimate, their particular environment that resulted in incremental changes within kind to result in all those strange animals.
Well, yes, I mean, that's obviously that particular climate was favorable to those animals that we, you know, now find today. Mm-hmm. And as you say, isolation does tend to preserve, if you will, a certain kind. Because, I mean, we can go to Galapagos and see animals there that aren't necessarily, you know, scattered about the earth. So that's kind of a similar type of situation, and so we have Australia that was isolated, big lizards, big snakes, and other animals, obviously the kangaroos and the wombats and things. But you know, those animals were probably present on the European continents as well. I mean, but other animals either killed them off, and so they didn't have the animals that survived on Australia, probably, you know, the predators weren't there to kill off the fuzzy little wombats. You had, you know, these various animals that wound up on Australia. So you had two sets. You had one set that got completely wiped out. And when we say completely wiped out, it just wasn't a little bit of water going across the land and they drowned. It was massive tidal waves that swept across the earth. And along with the tidal waves came massive amounts of earth that buried them very, very quickly. So we had, you know, a lot of animals that get buried, and then we discover the animals and look, oh, lo and behold, we have fossils.
And again, as to the timeline here, we're talking about geological changes on the face of the earth that lasted for 700, 800, maybe 1,000 years after the flood itself. Is that not correct?
Well, that brings up. They talk about the Ice Age in this article.
Mm-hmm. Interesting parallel here.
You know what happened to the Ice Age? Well, the first question you have to ask: what precipitated the Ice Age? And of course, the standard geological explanation that you're going to be told if you go to the university is that, oh, we've had multiple ice ages, and they're about they lasted for millions and millions of years, they're about 10,000 years apart, and we wind up with another ice age. But what precipitates an ice age? Well, you have to have warm water to begin with, and you have to have a cold earth, a cold land. So in the scenario of the global flood, we have warm water because the water was warm to start with, because the earth was perfect and the water was perfect, and so the water itself was warmer. And with all of the volcanic activity, then you have volcanic dust being thrown up in the air, which blocks the sunlight. And so post-flood, land would have been colder. So you've got warm water, which is generating tremendous amount of water vapor in the air. That water vapor has to go somewhere, and we've got colder continents at this time. And so it starts to precipitate as snow, and hence a lot of snow, because we've got all of this geological activity going on. And so the Ice Age is actually a result of the global flood. And so the fear that, oh, we're going to have another, mini Ice Age here, or, we're going to have another whatever is pretty bogus, because the Ice Age happened once. There were many interludes where, as I said, you had some volcanic activity. There was a lot of volcanic activity, then the volcanic activity subsided, and then things melted a little bit, and then there was more volcanic activity. So you went through multiple cycles. So the layers, the light and dark layers that we find in the ice, if you take ice cores, for example, is not necessarily resulting from a year cycle, as they have proposed, but is actually the cycle of the volcanoes that were going off at the time, which could have been on a monthly basis, more often than that. And so with having the wrong interpretation of the Ice Age, then you're going to come up with ages for these animals, tremendous ages for the animals, when indeed not so much. And
so Earth creationists would say essentially there was one Ice Age.
There was one, yes, there was
one true Ice Age. Other little dips in the climate here and there that caused like many Ice Ages in certain locales, but basically one global Ice Age.
Yes, one global Ice Age that lasted probably 700 or so years, maybe 1,000 years after the flood, which would have given plenty of time for animals to multiply, as well as man for that matter, and to disperse and migrate. And during that time you had the Tower of Babel, and everybody was kind of gathered in the Shinar Valley, Babel, of course, the Nimrod and all that story. God comes down, confuses their language, and they are now forced to disperse upon the earth. And the people's dispersion happened during that ice age. You know, when we look back at biblical history, if you will, then the animals, of course, have dispersed, and the land masses have now broken up and dispersed, all within this 700 year period of time. So you get a totally different picture from the biblical model, if you will, than you do from, let's say, the traditional geological model as to the timing of all of this. And so what happened at the end of the Ice Age explains what happened to the woolly mammoths that found areas of the northern parts of the earth, for example, in Russia and in Alaska or in Canada. There were regions where there was warm breezes that were keeping the grasslands and the vegetation green, post flood, that were not affected as much by the ice age. But as the ice age was progressing, the waters got colder, because the whole earth was getting cold at that time. And so you weren't having as much water being pumped up into the atmosphere. That then caused the atmosphere to get dry. And then there was a period of time at the very tail end of, in quote, the Ice Age, where there were massive, massive dust storms. I mean, we're talking about dust, hundreds and hundreds of feet thick that were being blown around because of these dust storms. And it was that dust that the woolly mammoths got caught in, as well as other animals. But standing up and, all of a sudden they're completely covered with hundreds of feet of dust and dirt. Because the earth was so dry at that point.
Well, so far then, we'd have to say that the argument posed in this article and young earth creationism go pretty well matched. In other words, it was an ice age that through a sequence of events resulted in the decimation of these large animals in Australia. And we can kind of agree with it that much. And so what they're saying in the article is that's the most recent science, and this idea that human beings caused the extinction of those animals basically is bunk. In fact, I got a kick out of one commentary here that talks about, let's see if I can scan down and get that real quick. I should be able to spot that. Oh, here it is. The problem is there's no hard evidence that humans were primarily to blame for the disaster that befell these giants. Judith Field, who's an archaeologist at the University of New South Wales, who focuses on megafauna and indigenous communities in Australia and New Guinea, says the hunting hypothesis has hung on because of its appealing simplicity. It's a good soundbite and a seductive argument to blame humans for the extinctions. And you know what else strikes me as a good soundbite and has appealing simplicity? Evolution. And I think I think that people clung to this explanation that humans did it the same way they cling to the notion that evolution happens, because it's appealing, it's easy to understand, and by tradition and bad habit, we start there. That's the starting point for our analysis of observation, of scientific observation. And in this article, they're saying it wasn't man, it was climate change, and we're saying, yeah, you're right. But then they go on to say that we should take note of this event in ancient Australian history because it portends what's going to happen next with now our human-caused climate change. So there's where we part ways. I suspect.
Oh my goodness! Well, yeah, there's two places where we part ways, because Vigel also talks about, well, there was the two sets of fossils that we're finding. There's an older set of 570,000 to 350,000 years old
timeline, fossils, yes,
that we find. that those, you know, probably got buried, like I said, during the flood. And then there is a newer set, 40,000 to 30,000 years old. Of course, these timelines I have to laugh at because, you know, as a young Earth creationist, you know, they don't make much sense. But that's another story to talk about, maybe at another time. But anyway, so there was, you know, mass extinction of the giants, if you will, which happened at the time of the flood, and then there was another extinction of some animals that was a result of a drier climate. Well, we know at the end of the Ice Age, the climate was drier because of the of what I had described before, that the Earth was warming up, and the oceans were cooling down, so the temperatures were beginning to equilibrate, and you had these massive winds and dust storms as a result. That, you know, precipitating the second wave, if you will, of destruction of the animals that originally came from the ark and then migrated down to various areas of the Earth, including Australia. Now, we would certainly not, I mean, in a sense, it's interesting because from a spiritual point of view, in a sense, man was responsible for the global flood. And so, in a sense, he was responsible for this drier climate that happened, you know, post-flood. You know,
I never looked at it that way, but you're right.
You know, so... Now, they go one step further and say, oh, because of this... interesting, the political correctness that must be in these articles. Because you have... you know, this gal saying that, oh, you know, we've got, we know that we've got climate change and it's a result of man. And no, we don't. We know that the climate is changing, as you mentioned earlier, but we do not know how much influence man is having on the climate, because there are mega influences for things that are outside our control, like the sun. So when the sun has more spot activity, if you will, or solar flares, we know that more energy is given off in the sun, and man couldn't even approach the amount of energy that is given off by the sun to cause a warmer climate here on Earth. That correlation has been made is, you know, quite good, and we know that it's a 50 or so year cycle. And so... but when, of course, the solar activity decreases, guess what happens here on Earth? The Earth gets cooler, and we go through a cycle of coolness. It wasn't that long ago when they were saying, oh, man's activities is causing this cool wave, and we're going into a mini ice age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't quite go into a mini ice age. We just got cooler for a period of time, and now we're going up into a little bit warmer period. And the earth over the time period when all of this climate discussion was taking place, maybe it has increased a degree. And you know, a degree, okay, yes, some things are going to melt, and the oceans are going to rise a little bit, but we're not talking about mass, you know, hysteria here, where all of the cities along the coast are going to be flooded, and so we need to do something about it, and then the interior of the continents are going to be all burnt up. Now, there is going to come a time where that is going to be the case, but that is judgment, on man, and is not caused by man in a sense, other than it's caused spiritually by man, but it is allowed to happen, you know, by God himself.
This is the big story that maybe half of modern science chooses to ignore. It doesn't fit their paradigm. But we should also mention here that there are a lot of scientists who look at the same data and conclude different things, you know, things other than man-caused climate change.
Well, exactly right. And as I said before, you know, how much is caused by man and how much is caused by natural things that is happening. And, you know, there's going to come a time when a third of the earth is going to burn up. What is man going to say when that happens?
I know what Al Gore would say.
You see, I told you so.
Yeah.
I told you.
Yeah. I told you this was going to happen.
Yeah. Somebody's going to make a lot of money.
Let me get into my jet. Yeah. I've been, you know, while we've been discussing this and, you know, haven't been dozing off, I've actually been doing something else. And I've been looking at, you know, continental drift. There's a map on YouTube that suggests that this, you know, that was how the continents formed in the theory of Pangaea and all, and the massive continent. And then they've got an extrapolation of the map into the future, assuming there's going to be one. But, you know, and we don't know about that. But it's an interesting thought. How solid is the continental drift theory? And notice
it's
a theory, it's not a law, but you know, according to this, you know, that map, Australia sinks into the ocean.
Well, yes, I don't know about the projections, because the theory that the continents actually did, you know, there was Pangaea and it actually broke it apart, that is a sound theory. The time frame is wrong.
Right.
Because they, you know, they say that happened over millions of years and the continents are drifting very, very slowly apart. They made their error when they looked at, well, how far, you know, how much are they moving right now? And then you project that into the past, and then you can say, oh, in order to get this distance, it took this many years, you know, to get there. Mm-hmm. But the events that were happening at the time of the flood were so catastrophic that things were moving. The earth was moving very, very, very quickly.
And there's an implicit assumption in these modern scientific thoughts that say everything is as it always was. Change and micro changes are happening all the time at a constant rate. The earth's magnetic field is the same as it always has been. Gravity is the same as it always has been. Isn't that where the error comes in?
Oh, very much so, because that's the you know, the uniformitarian concept, that what we see today is what happened back then. And if you have a global catastrophe like a flood, you know, that type of theory does not fit at all, because it doesn't take into account catastrophes. Now, there are other theories that, you know, catastrophe theory, for example, that takes into account catastrophes. But the global catastrophe of a flood, for example, and the resultant volcanic activity, while we can, as a young Earth creationist, we can, you know, describe and explain a lot of things that we, you know, see in the geology of Earth, we can also understand that the continents would have had to move faster because there was more magma being pumped out at the time, which was actually lubricating the crust, you know, on the bottom, and allowing the continents to move further apart. Now, have the question, I think one of the questions that you were asking is, although you didn't ask it, is, are we at equilibrium now? In other words, have the continents moved, you know, as far apart as they're going to move apart, or are they still moving? And I think that would be, you know, obviously worth studying, and they must be moving, you know, it's not moving at certainly at the rate that it was post.
And of course, post-war. and until modern technology, there was probably no way to determine that, no accurate way, because the movement would have been so slight over, say, the span of a human life. But now with lasers and whatnot, we could probably measure it to some degree, at least.
And with GPS, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you know what the coordinates are, mm-hmm. and you can see, you know, see how things are.
But that's changing. That's been around for only a few years. It might take a generation to have enough data to actually reach some conclusions.
Right. And with satellite imagery, I mean, all the technology that we have today, I mean, we can measure very, very accurately small shifts in movement, for example. And then, of course, we can, you know, project backwards or even project forwards if we wanted to. But, you know, what will happen in the future, I think all that we need to do is that make sure our hearts are right with God, and everything will pan out in the end.
Interesting. An interesting article here, too. And again, there's a link in our chat window at brokenroadradio.com if you'd like to read the article. It's not very long. It's interesting. And compare it with what you've just heard about young earth creationism and see if you can contrast the articles and understand the difference in the thinking between the two. And it seems to me that this is such a humanist approach. It elevates man to a level he doesn't deserve yet, that he's the mover and shaker, and it ignores the bigger story altogether. That's my opinion. And I invite you to take a look at the article and see what you think. Don Clark, again, a member of the board of Creation Moments, and you might want to check out the Creation Moments website. There is a convenient link for you on our website. It's creationmoments.com. They have a wonderful library of resources on the science that speaks to young earth creationism, and I think you'll find it intriguing and very likely convincing. The trouble is, not a lot of people get exposed to that science, and it's a science as valid as any others. And it's founded on the Bible, which is a good place to start when you're putting the pieces of the greater history of man together. Excellent place to start. Don, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate the analysis, and we'll look forward to next week. Okay?
Okay, very good. Nice being with you folks, too.
Yeah.
Take care.
Good talking to you, Don.
Bye-bye.